A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Hi, I'm John McEnroe, and you're listening to the Tennis Podcast.
Well, hello and welcome to the Tennis Podcast. We are here at the Royal Albert Hall, the Statoil Masters Tennis, once more, and after special guests of Pat Cash and John McEnroe on the first 2 days. Catherine Whittaker, who have we got today?
You get me to announce the guest every day.
That's your role now.
Oh, a very important role it is too. We've got Andy Roddick with us.
Hello, Andy Roddick.
How did you get Johnny Mac to do a podcast?
I tell you, I just asked him, and hey, presto.
How big was your gun?
Well, I don't know. I'm a big bloke, and I just stood there really imposing. Wow. And then just hoped for the best. That's, and it happened.
I guess miracles do happen.
They do. Yeah. What do you think of our little tennis court inside an arena that normally has music?
Yeah, it's pretty cool. I actually was... I played Bruguera earlier today here, and on the switch over there, we're given kind of the history of Royal Albert Hall, and you know it was pretty cool to see. You know, from what was it, 1871, and you know it was such a unique visual structure from the air, so it didn't get bombed during the war. It's just when they start throwing out things like that, it becomes very surreal, as if just the beauty of the place wasn't surreal enough. It's a cool place for some tennis for sure.
You know, they once ran a marathon here. They once hosted a marathon in the Royal Albert Hall, and they did like 2,000 laps or so. I'm doing the maths in my head about how many laps it would be, but they just did laps and laps inside the Albert Hall.
It's funny because I was trying to think of what would be worse than a marathon. What would be worse than a marathon? I guess 2,000 laps of a marathon would probably be worse.
That would be rough. You're into your history, given that you've played Wimbledon many times and Queens, a tournament with more than a century. This tournament has got about 17 years of history. It started in 1997. When I was doing my research, I realized you hadn't even turned pro yet when this tournament first started. Now here you are playing it.
No, let's see, 97. I finished that year. I was busy finishing a robust 48 in the country and 16 and unders in the USA. So the Royal Albert Hall was a long ways away for me in 1997, both in terms of skill and age.
And these days, we know what you're doing with yourself because we are avid followers of the Fox Sports Live podcast, which we are two of the how many listeners you have?
I think we're up to nine.
So double figures is just around the corner.
It's a little intimidating to look at, you know, 20-some-odd% of our actual listenership, you know, which is, you know, I don't know how many we've done by now. It's got to be 70, 80 done in just complete obscurity. So I appreciate it. And I think it's all a ploy just to get me to do this 10 minutes of podcast.
It is. And absolutely. And for all the 15 of you listening to this,
if you do that, I'm starting to kind of tick the boxes on what you would have had to do for Johnny Mac. And I feel like it might be disgusting.
It is pretty rough, actually. Yeah, you wouldn't have wanted to be present. But anyway, he did it, and you can listen to it, Andy Roddick. If you download the Tennis Podcast and you subscribe on iTunes, I've heard this somewhere before, subscribe on iTunes, and while you're there, subscribe on iTunes to the Fox Sports Live podcast. Whoa. And the Fox Sports Live TV show, which goes out at 8 o'clock, something or other.
We don't have a lot of viewership here in England. We don't have much viewership in the States. Much.
This is global. So, podcasts are global.
I'm trying to help you out with that.
Yeah, 11 Eastern. If you're bored, 8 Pacific.
You are indeed, absolutely. What has it been like, though, to do something like that? Because, I mean, you know, we see tennis players and athletes go into the commentary box all the time in their chosen sport. You're talking, I mean, I have to be honest, I understand about 10% of what you lot are talking about on that show. But I still enjoy it. But it's a different type of discipline, isn't it?
Yeah, and to be fair to you, I know about 10% of what I'm talking about. So the rest is just shit. I don't know if we can say that on your podcast.
You can, because I've found a beeper button that I can bleep that out.
Well, only quitters press the bleeper button. But no, it's fun. You know, I had some nice opportunities to go back into straight into the commentary box for tennis. But in my mind, I don't know that I could rationalize traveling to talk about tennis when I still felt like I could probably travel and play it. You know, I retired and I could still swing it a little. So that was a tough kind of thing to rationalize in my mind.
Yeah, it's a pretty cool setup you've got really there, isn't it? Because not only are you going to LA and occasionally doing these shows, you're also doing your podcast from your own house.
Yeah, it's pretty. I did, I think it was 7 months last year, Monday through Friday in studio for Fox, which wasn't something that I thought I would do straight out of tennis so soon. But you know, there's no control for timing of opportunities. So I guess I won their trust a little bit, and now we have equipment in a room in my house. So that works out a little bit better. The commute's a little shorter from the kitchen to the podcast room in Austin than it is from Austin to LAX.
No, absolutely. Now, just a few questions from our listeners that have come in here. When you first played Rafael Nadal, we've got down here 2004 Davis Cup. Is that about right?
It's about right. I played him at the U.S. Open that year, second round, and then again at Davis Cup on clay a couple months later.
And when you came off that court and saw what he was all about, I mean, what were your impressions of him?
Well, it was two different opinions. Playing him on a fast court, his first match in Arthur Ashe Stadium when I had played there a bunch, that's probably about as big of an advantage as anyone's ever had over Rafa as far as circumstance and I guess the scenery and the whole deal on a fast hard court when I was two in the world and he wasn't Rafa yet. And then it my opinion changed drastically after playing him on clay in Seville, cold weather, with 28,000 of his closest friends cheering him on. So after the U.S. Open, I said he's going to be a good player. I don't know that he serves big enough to make it big. That shows you how much I know. And then after I played him in Seville, I said he's gonna win seven French Opens. And little did I know, I was selling him short, actually.
Yeah, I remember that. I remember that was from a couple of years ago, you saying that Doug Spreen had said that he would win eight.
He said he'd win eight, so he was completely wrong.
What was he thinking?
Apparently the truth. I mean, when you start throwing around those numbers, it's like, you know, Rafa on clay now, it's like it almost looks like he's playing Xbox when you get like really good at a video game. That's how easy clay looks to him.
Sure does. We have that was from Avril Leah, and we have Antonio Goran, who says, how long did you take to get over that 09 defeat at Wimbledon? Did that sit with you for a while?
Yeah, I don't know how to. It's tough to, you know, it's like anything. First couple days afterwards, I woke up and it was the first thing I thought of when I woke up from sleep. And then, you know, you're walking around and you kind of get the sinking feeling. And then, you know, I pulled out of a couple of tournaments that summer because I wasn't in the space to play tennis again. And gosh, I was out at Wimbledon yesterday with Tim Henman. I had my first spot of tea with Tim Henman at Wimbledon. Is that like the English dream right there?
I'll tell you, that is quintessential. I
mean, that's like, you know, that's like Rafa winning his first French Open right there. I feel like I really nailed tea.
And how was tea at Wimbledon?
It was fantastic. It was great. No better place. I was completely off topic. I have no idea what we were just talking about.
We were talking about tea at Wimbledon, but the question you answered was about Wimbledon and 09 and the defeat there.
I'm back on track. But it's just one of those things where the more space I had from it, the more I actually appreciated what happened. You know, the first thing for the first couple weeks afterwards, you just think of it in a context of when, you know, you lost. The thing that kind of opened my eyes was, you know, I didn't pay much attention to it. I was kind of home in my bubble, just trying to get away from everything, you know, down in Texas, and wasn't reading much or looking at much. And then the next event I played was a month later in Washington. And I remember showing up for my first practice there. And going out, and there was they put the practice court on one of the match courts, but there were no matches on at that time, and we had a couple thousand watching practice. And then I played the next night on a random Tuesday night, which, you know, you fill the stadium towards the end of the tournament, but you don't towards the beginning. But it was sold out, and I walked out, and it was just the place, you know, fell to pieces. And it was the first time after that match. I'm thankful for it because I felt like I was understood. I played a lot of roles. I played, you know, the brat, the hope, the all this. But after that, I think people just realized I was just a dude who, you know, played well in a couple of Wimbledons, and that's where I was happy being.
You mentioned, you said you played a couple of roles. One of them was you had a couple of spectacularly magnificent rows with umpires in your early years, pre-Hawkeye. Yeah. Now, I remember you being one of the first players who said, Hawkeye's brilliant. Mm-hmm. Takes all that sure. nonsense out of the game. Do you feel the same now?
No, I don't. And listen, I'm the first... You view things through a certain lens while you're playing, and it you allow yourself to change once you're done. And when I was a player, that pissed me off how people would flip-flop. But, you know, 06, I was purely thinking about I wanted to get it right. I remember an example of mine is the 01 U.S. Open when I got a really bad call against Leighton, and that I think that had ramifications for the entire tournament. He went on to win. I was playing great going in, didn't get it. So I didn't ever want to finish a tournament thinking that a call may or may not have affected the outcome. On a bigger scale, the entire business of tennis is eyeballs on TV sets. And if someone's arguing with a referee loudly and aggressively, the eyeballs will remain on the TV set. And I think Hawkeye has actually taken away a little bit of that personality in tennis. So I completely get that the players want it. I think it works great. I think it is. It's been a success as far as serving its purpose, and I would get rid of it.
Right, Catherine, Andy and I are in agreement. We want to get rid of Hawkeye. How do we sort this out? You know people.
Do I get the deciding vote?
Yeah. You've got to sort it out. You're responsible now.
A lot of pressure.
Well, I'm in favour of it in general. I'm quite swayed by your argument. I think there is generally quite a sterilization of sport, but I think if you take that argument to its logical conclusion, then, you know, you look at football, soccer in this country, there's such a strong argument that the rows with umpires or referees in football, it can be quite uncomfortable. It's not a good advert for the sport. You could eliminate that to a certain extent with video replays. I think on balance, it's a positive thing. I do think there's a certain element of the novelty having worn off with Hawkeye. You know, at the time it was exciting, and what you lost in personality, you gained in the novelty of Hawkeye. That's gone now.
I think I think we can meet in the middle here. Let's just cut it down to one challenge for a match. And if you get it wrong, you're out of challenges.
I'm up for that.
I'll go for that.
As long as you get them right, you can keep it rolling, but you have to be pretty – and I was guilty of it too. If you're 30-40 on someone's serve and you know they hit a good shot, you still review it. It wastes a lot of time. We know we can get away with it. We have three. When are you ever going to, you know, guess three? The only reason you use three is because you can, you know. And so maybe you have one at the beginning of a match, and that's it for the entire match. So, you know, as long as you save it, you can't complain about a bad call because that means you misused your challenges somewhere along the line.
Don't you think to a certain extent, if you're the sort of guy that argues with an umpire, you're going to find a way? You know, John McEnroe finds a way to argue over a line call.
Oh, no, come on. There would not have been. You cannot be serious with Hawkeye.
Yeah. I mean, there's two things there. When you're arguing without proof, an argument can take longer. They're not going to give you a time violation when it's basically you have an opinion. But if your opinion has just been proven on a massive board for the entire arena to see, I don't think the umpire is going to have a hard time giving you time violation, point penalties, and they'd probably be right in that judgment.
But I think we've agreed. One challenge it is, then.
I like it.
Right, okay, that's sold. A couple of final points, Andy. Yeah, well, I'll tell you, now we've got the really important stuff coming up now. Because for the first time in the 7 years Catherine and I have known each other, tomorrow morning we are playing each other at tennis.
Wow.
Right? I've never seen her play. Okay. She's never seen me play. Okay. Last night I got tips from John McEnroe, who said that I've got to be like Todd Martin, take a bit off my serve and be a bit more percentages.
Okay.
You beat Ivo Karlovic in the final at Queens in 2005, I think it was.
Yeah.
Right. What has she got to do against a Goliath freak like me?
Yeah, I mean, you know, generally pretty tall, pretty gangly, very pale. You got to make pale.
Translucent.
People. You got to make translucent people move. You know, that's the book on it. You know, that's it. Movement's going to be a tough one. You don't strike me as a gazelle per se.
I think that's fair. Yeah. Actually, I think that's fair. Well, you've just had a tip from Andy Roddick. How do you feel about that, Catherine? Are you going to take that and run?
I told her nothing she didn't already know, by the way.
Yeah, well, we've been over this. My predictions are that it's not going to be pretty, but it's going to be it's going to be effective.
I'm unorthodox and effective, she thinks. Final point, Andy Roddick, while you're here. Bill Reiter, can I have his autograph? He's I've got a bit of a man crush.
Really?
Yeah.
So you're the one.
He's too cool.
It's exciting. We found the Bill Reiter fan. That's
Do you know what I like about him?
You know what the weird part is that the people listening to this right now are going, who the hell is Bill Reiter?
That's the beauty. Now they go and find out who it is.
And they're going to say he looks exactly like Fred Savage from The Wonder Years.
That's exactly what he does look like from what I've seen on Twitter. What I like is Andy Roddick, you were hard work when we were in press conferences, and he gives you some back. It's brilliant.
Well, he does on air anyways.
He sure does. Andy Roddick, pleasure to have you with us on the Tennis Podcast. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term medical plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term medical plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com. Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.